Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast for December 15th. It's brought to you by One World Sports. I'm John Gibson, and joining me from the Major League Baseball winter meetings in San Diego is Jim Allen. What's happening, bud? Can you hear me way over there?
Hold on. I pull a string on our cup and string connection a little tighter.
Cup and string connection.
It's a long way to go. Okay. Well, technically, it's the baseball winter meetings, and it's organized largely by the minor league baseball people.
Well, I just
They're the ones actually to decide. And the baseball MLB sort of piggybacks on top of that. It's a three-ring circus.
I just wanted to make sure that our non-regular listeners know that it's not baseball meetings held for NPB.
Ah, well done.
That's all I'm looking for.
Okay, good.
If we have two sets of winter meetings somewhere, then somebody's missing out somewhere.
Yeah, well, all I can think of when I'm here is that...
Weather's great.
What?
The weather's great.
In the daytime, it feels like Tokyo in August, and at nighttime, it feels like Tokyo in December.
Yeah. All right. Well, on this week's show, we've got an interview with Hiroshima Carp front office executive Jonathan Fine, and we're going to talk about free agents, domestic and stateside. So let's get started.
Clearing the bases.
Well, okay, since this is my time for trivia, I've got some lame stuff for you, John, so get ready. Here it comes. Don't laugh when I say it.
Okay, I'm not laughing.
Okay, so this is kind of the baseball winter meetings, as they're technically known, is kind of a slow one this year for Japanese guys. We have one free agent moving from Japan, but we have no posted players on the radar. People are still talking about Kenta Maeda, but, you know.
The talk
is cheap. People are still talking about, you know, the problem with vaccinations, you know, back in the Roosevelt administration. You know, it's something they ain't going to, you know, no matter how much they talk about it, ain't going to change anything.
Right.
So we have no posted players, so there's no hubbub about that. Nobody's walking up to me and saying, tell me about what's the situation with Kenta Maeda.
Right.
Since the Hiroshima Carp are here, that they would have been great for that. But anyway, so speaking of posting players, a little historical posting trivia.
Okay.
I'm sure you know part of the answer, but have probably forgotten. So, okay.
Thank you for the compliment.
Who was the first player, or who were the first players posted?
I did know that. In fact, I believe we talked about it on the show this year.
Sure, we did, because I have a big storehouse of large, useless trivia facts in my apartment that my wife keeps bugging me to sell at the garage sale.
Don't the wives always do that? Man, what is up with that, man?
Get your own little
space and then throw your own stuff away. How's that?
Let's not go there. They're good at it. So my thing is, if you're good at something, let them do it. So she does that. Anyway, I pulled that out of the drawer and I found this. So who were the first posted players to go to be offered to the majors through the posting system?
I'm gonna say Hideo Nomo.
Oh man!
Oh
that's really bad.
Bad.
And let me just tell you, John isn't the one who just woke up. Just so you don't get kind of slack on that one.
Yeah, Jim's getting up early to do this taping of the show on Thursday when we're actually coming out with it on Monday. In fact, I'll see you before this thing is updated.
We're gonna be long gone.
Well,
but
come
I'm
on,
gonna,
man. Hideki Inabu.
We're getting warmer.
I'm trying to go back in time. I don't think Murakami was
going back in time, and you've got
Murakami wasn't a posted player, was he?
They were not.
So
they existed before the posting system, before Hideo Nomo. Nobody ever thought of a posting system. And then Hideki Urabu began to start those clocks turning. Actually, Hideki Urabu was the third guy to move from Japan. The second player who moved from Japan has just announced this year that he is retiring from the major leagues. That would actually have been a better trivia question, I'm reckoning. But that guy was, and the hint is, that guy, well, the hint is not going to help, because unless you know these little fish, you're not going to get it. That guy was Rafael Soriano.
Oh.
Not the posted player, but he was the next guy after Hideo Nomo to go.
Right.
Hideo
Nomo, and he's Rafael the one who, Soriano. He's the one who then, retired this year.
And he's the one who retired. Mm-hmm. Borderline Hall of Famer. Okay, now, they wanted to deny him, but they couldn't. They wanted to deny Irabu, but they couldn't. And Soriano, actually, I'll be honest, I don't recall whether Soriano was first or Irabu was first, but they were essentially in that same boat. They were both, all three of those guys were represented by agent Don Nomura,
mm-hmm.
who would have been good to have on the show. I said hello to him the other day.
Okay.
But the next two guys, on February 2nd, 1999, the Hiroshima Carp posted Alejandro Quesada, Quesada. With a Z, and a Timoniel Perez.
Ah.
And Quesada was posted. He was the first. They were both posted on the same day. And I believe the Cincinnati Reds won the rights to Quesada with a bid of something like $500,000.
Mm-hmm. I remember Perez and him going, yeah.
Yes, Timoniel Perez, or Timo Perez as he became known, played for a few major league teams, and after the Carp released him, I think a year later, his issue, he was a guy I really liked because I thought he was 3 years younger than he was. His age changed after 9/11, as it did with many Latin players.
Yeah.
So here I was, I'm going, we've got this 18-year-old who's ripping up the Western League.
But he's really...
Maybe he was a 19-year-old, but he was 22.
Mm.
And then I'm thinking, wow, this guy's really, you know, this is a guy who can play. But, you know, I was comparing his performance to 19-year-olds. And he was 3 years older.
Yeah, that's not fair.
So, okay. Yeah, it's not fair. It's not fair, Timoniel.
Timo. I didn't think it was Nomo, but I could, and it's all coming back to me now that he actually had to retire, right?
Correct.
And then go over to the States. So, but yeah, it's all fuzzy. All those old memories. And I would never guess these guys, you know, Perez, Quesada, never, ever.
Quesada, I know I can't remember here. Perez, I did remember because I was just beginning to play fantasy baseball here in Japan. And he was a guy I just loved because I thought, man, this guy's going to go somewhere, until I found out he was using a fake driver's license. So, yeah, so anyway, so the Carp were big, and Soriano, of course, was with the Carp, and all these things were going on. Then these guys were testing the waters. We didn't have any big posted players, and we did have other guys move to the States. We had Shigetoshi Hasegawa move the same year moved in the year after Nomo, mm-hmm. and that was the Oryx Blue Wave, basically had agreed to let him go to the majors at some point.
Mm-hmm.
He signed out of university. So they basically said, go and good luck. He'd been a very good player for them, and they let him go. And Irabu said, me too.
I want to go. No,
and they said, okay, anyway, so, yes, speaking of the Hiroshima Carp, and they were here in San Diego. I was talking to the Carp the other day, and there are two scouts, Eric Schulstrom, the two Hiroshima Carp scouts surprised me because I didn't recognize either of them. I hadn't seen either of them in so long. The first was Eric Schulstrom, who I didn't remember very well. I remember his name more than his face. And the one that shocked me was Scott McLean, who I was very – as close as I am with foreign players, I was probably closest with Scott McLean than anybody who came to Japan, other maybe than Tuffy Rhodes. And he lost – he was completely bald, so I didn't recognize him. He used to have quite a bit of hair.
Mm-hmm.
But when I saw it, somebody said, you know, he introduced himself and he spoke very softly. And I said, oh, yeah. I'm going like, look, my eyes were, you know, the lights were on, but nobody was home kind of look. But we're talking and I'm talking to Schulstrom and says, now that guy introduced himself to me and I'm supposed to know him, but who is it? And he says, no, it's Scott McLean. And I'm going, no. Whoa. So anyway, I was really blown away. So this is a guy we talked quite a bit when he was with the Cebu Lions. We didn't talk much when he came back for another cup of coffee with a Hiroshima Carp. But anyway, so that was good. And there was another fellow. There were two front office guys, Japanese guys, two young guys, both former interpreters / PR guys, mm-hmm. who are running their overseas development. And there was another guy. And I said, this guy wearing glasses and very, well, he and I were competing for the most pasty complexioned people in San Diego this weekend.
And the good thing is you mm-hmm. stayed indoors almost all the time. So that didn't improve anything.
Well, actually, we had to hold the interview outside because it was quieter.
Mm.
Inside is like, it's like going to the ballpark. It has a constant hum. Mm. The lobby of the Grand Hyatt Hotel here in San Diego, the Manchester Grand Hyatt Hotel in San Diego, is vibrating with people buzzing and talking. You have to step outside for peace and quiet.
Mm.
So I goosed this guy. So I said, you know, this is kind of interesting. This fellow, Jonathan Fine, is an assistant general manager for the Hiroshima Carp, in charge of overseas acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had to get this guy's story. And it really blew me away. In retrospect, I'm thinking it's a very kind of a, now he's got a kind of a dull job, but his story of how he got the job was really cool.
Mm.
So let's listen to Mr. Jonathan Fine.
Okay, our guest today on the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast is Jonathan Fine of the Hiroshima Carp, and thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Happy to talk with you.
Okay, well, we just met Jonathan. I just met Jonathan yesterday at the baseball winter meetings here in San Diego, and I was quite surprised to find that the Carp had an American executive working for them in the United, running their American or overseas operations or something. Could you tell us what it is that you do for the Carp?
I'm not exactly sure myself sometimes. Essentially, I have been the business guy that helps to acquire foreign talent for the Hiroshima Club for about 20 years now. And it essentially entails meeting with, working with representative major league teams when we have to purchase a player's rights from the team, and obviously working on the player contracts with the agents. We have a couple of U.S.-based scouts now, and as do many of the other Japanese clubs, but I don't do any of the talent identification. Once that process takes place, both here in the States and over in Japan, then they say, here's your budget, go get them. And that's what I do.
So now you have a very... what's a good word for it? Eclectic background.
Eclectic, huh? Yeah, I guess that's a good word for it.
You studied history?
I studied history in college, a little bit of everything. I had just enough credits to have a major in something. But, I had an interest in baseball. My illustrious playing career ended in high school. But I managed to wrangle a job with my local AAA team for a couple of summers while I was in college and studied some Japanese in college and wanted to combine those two interests after college.
How did that work out?
Well, I was fortunate. I basically wrote a cover letter to all the 12 MPB teams at the time. This was the late 1980s. And the Hiroshima team got back to me, and through sort of a circuitous process, which surprised me a little bit, they brought me over, and I went to work in their front office for about 2 years.
Yeah. So from what I understand, you got a call from a New York lawyer. You got a call claiming to be a New York lawyer. And you thought it was a practical joke?
I did. Yeah, I was summoned to New York City. I didn't think this stood a snowball's chance in Hades of coming off. And I did get a telephone call from a guy who turned out to be a business representative for the Hiroshima Club in New York City, asking me to come to New York. I was in Virginia at the time to interview, and I didn't believe. I thought it was a practical joke. I thought it was a prank pulled by one of my friends, and so. I told him somewhat flippantly, sure, I can be at your office tomorrow morning or whatever it was. And he said, great, I'll see you there. And after he gave me the address and I hung up, I realized I had not been the victim of a joke, but that indeed I had an interview in New York City the next morning. And so I hightailed it up there as best I could. And, the rest is history.
Okay, the rest is history. So And this is like history unfolding before our noses. I've been following Japanese baseball for close to 30 years, and I didn't know Mr. Fine existed. So he's sort of like the secret weapon of the Hiroshima Garb.
Yeah, it's funny you should put it that way. That's kind of exactly how I perceive myself. I think that we have been somewhat innovative in our approach to foreign player acquisition over the years, and I did play a role in sort of developing that program, but I am very, very happy to maintain my role behind the scenes and playing the part that I do. We have excellent scouts both here in the United States and in Japan, and really they do the lion's share of the work in identifying the talent, not just in terms of on the field what matches up with the Carp's needs for Gai Kokujin players, but also, you know, who's got the makeup, who's got the character, the ability to be a success in what it takes to be a success as a foreign player in Japan. I just go out and actually see if I can sign them the contracts.
Now, you practiced law after you came back from Japan, right?
That's right. I'm a practicing attorney. I went to law school, graduated, and almost immediately upon graduation started working on the foreign player contracts for the Carp. In fact, that was in the early 90s. The very first player contract I worked on was Marty Brown, who later became the manager of the Carp.
Marty Brown. Who is that guy? I don't know. We know Marty? Oh, that's the guy. Okay, well, I'm not gonna say anything bad about Marty today.
But the truth is, we've been extremely fortunate in that a lot of the guys that I have worked on signing over the years and that our scouts have worked on identifying, we're doing something right, because oftentimes these guys end up playing for other Japanese teams in the tail end of their playing careers after they've played with us.
Yep.
And if you look around the league, many of those guys are now in front office or scouting positions with other Japanese clubs. Just go down the list.
Okay, I'll add something that I did a study several years ago to identify the teams that had produced the most foreign talent. And the teams, and actually I related that with their salaries, and the Carp were I'm going from my memory, but either the Carp or the Swallows were far away ahead of everybody else, and those two were 1-2. So now we know one piece of that puzzle for the Carp. Mr. Fine's efforts.
I think it's a piece. Absolutely, it's a piece. I think resource efficiency has always been one of our battle cries in this process.
That's very Hiroshima Carp. Yes. We have other thoughts that come to mind with Hiroshima Carp and finances. So, tell me, what do you enjoy most about your job?
I went to work for this team for a couple of years after college, and they hired me, as I related before, sight unseen, more or less. They had an American representative in New York hire me, but none of the people that actually made the decisions back in Japan had ever met me. And here I am, this young guy, and as far as I could tell, in terms of a post-college experience, no one had ever really done this before. It was somewhat unique, but the Carp have always, and their ownership, have always been very internationally minded, very innovative, you know, with their Dominican Academy and many of the programs they've set up. And I like to think that I was part of that, and that I've always been, even after I came back to the States, part of that closely knit family. I mean, I always think of my life in Hiroshima and the work that I do with the Carp as a part of me that's always existed on the other side of the planet, and I can go there and just feel very comfortable with those people and in that city as if I never left. And that's a special part of my life, and I enjoy being able to help them like I can now.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, and we'll stay in touch with you.
Absolutely. Sounds good.
And good luck.
Thanks, Jim.
Okay.
Thanks again, Jonathan. Hopefully I will see you again 12 months from now in Nashville, Tennessee at the next baseball winter meetings.
Yeah, and hopefully I'll get to meet you one day. It was a fascinating story.
It was something. And so what did you do the same thing when I told you the Carp had an American assistant general manager, that you went, huh?
Yeah, I mean, let me set this up for the listeners. Jim said I talked to a front office exec for the Hiroshima Carp, and I'll send it to you. And then he sent it to me, so I really didn't know anything. I didn't have a setup like you guys had this setup, this intro to his chat. So I'm sitting there thinking, wow, this guy basically cold called with letters, with a letter writing campaign, these 12 NPB teams looking for a job. And I'm like, you know, that really took some gumption back in the late 80s. I mean, gosh. And then he said he studied a little bit of Japanese, so that probably helped. But then I thought, you know, the way we study Japanese in the States, and if you don't come and live over here, it's really, really hard to pick it up. Mm. And so I just wondered, there were all kinds of thoughts swimming around in my mind as I was listening to the first part. But I guess the biggest thing for me was that he said, and you can see it probably from the time that he said he started writing the letters to the time he actually procured the job, that there's a gap there. And he said, a circuitous process. But I mean, like, you know, when you don't come to Japan and you don't know that everything is a circuitous process, then that's what you come to assume. But I mean, you come here and live, it only takes a month before you realize that every single...
I just looked up circuitous in my dictionary here, and it has a diagram, it has a map of Japan with a big red arrow pointing to it.
and the Japanese flag, I'm sure. Right. Which is actually...
because it's circular.
It's because it's circular. All right, so I guess he knows that by now. But you called him a secret weapon, and I guess, I don't know, I looked at him as... Of course, he doesn't identify talent or take part in that part of the player acquisition. He's the eye dotter. He's the T crosser. He's the guy who finishes it up.
He is now. And it's, you know, we only have a limited amount of time to talk. And he wasn't slipping into lawyer mode. But this guy's it's quite amazing to me. John and I came to Japan for different reasons and different motivations, essentially. Yeah, I can't speak for John. And to be honest, John and I've never spoken about why he came to Japan. I talk about it all the time. But, you know, it's interesting to hear people say, I wanted to go to Japan, but I didn't want to be an English teacher, which I do hear. But it's everybody says it, but few people do it.
Mm-hmm.
Most people come because somebody's paying them to come.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they find somebody sends them. Oh, you want to go? No, but you're going. And that happens. Anyway, so he came, and he's just like, he's this ball of fire, you know. He's a history major, and he's a ball of fire, and it was really cool. And he told me it was a horror story at the time about how he was describing the old CARP front office, which looks like, in my mind, I pictured the Yakult Swallows front office, how it used to look. Where there's you walk in and it looks like you're going into a post office. You know, there's a counter and there's like a reception person standing behind the counter, and there's a bunch of people slaving away at desks pushed back to back.
Yeah, very small, crowded office, right?
Yeah, small, and you can smell the cigarette smoke, and you can see the green tea stains on the files, and everybody wearing suits in, you know, like,
tired
95
suits.
Degree weather.
Tired suits.
And yeah, and everything's gray and black. You know, I'm thinking back late 80s, a little color, but not much. And so I'm having this image, and he's telling me about this story, which I will relate. He was still learning kanji when he first, the Chinese character writing system for Japanese, when he arrived in Japan, and he wasn't familiar with, he was staying at the Hiroshima CARP team dormitory for the minor leaguers in Hiroshima City, and it was about a 20-minute bus ride to the CARP office, and he had to be there every day at 10 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And his kanji, at that point, after a month or so, he could read, he could speak and listen well enough to do a number of things that they asked him to. But they had a rule, you must speak Japanese to Jonathan, because they wanted him to improve his Japanese, to become an asset for the team, as opposed to just saying, oh, sorry, your Japanese isn't good, get on the next bus home. So anyway, speaking of the bus, he had trouble, he was not fast enough reading the kanji on the buses that were coming up to him, and he missed his bus one day. He gets to the office, and his coworker sitting next to, at the adjoining desk, said, "Don't do that again. Can't be late." Okay, well, a week later, he is late.
Don't do that again. Here's again.
Here's again. I'm again 10 minutes late. He comes in. He sits down. The place, I don't want to embellish, but anyway, the guy who's the team director at that time is the current owner. The current member of the Matsuda family who owns the CARP, or is the owner, which is different from he owns the CARP in Japan. The owner's a position on the team like a GM or a bat boy. It doesn't mean he actually owns the team. Anyway, was the director, and he said he called him over in Japanese to his desk, and then he stood up, and then he blasted him in English. He basically, to use a colloquial expression, he ripped him a new one.
Right.
And for some period of time in front of everybody. Mm. And he said that was a turning point for him in the sense that he realized, you know, when he reflected on his misdeeds and what going on, he realized what a golden opportunity he was getting.
Mm.
In that they were treating him and giving him the full press. This is what it's like to be in a worthless, thankless job as a Japanese salaryman.
Right. Right.
Well, I threw in the worthless, thankless bit.
No, I'm here in Japan. I can see it.
The cultural adjustment and really learn. And he said that was invaluable to him as an individual. And because as foreigners here, you're used to being either deferred to mm-hmm. or ignored.
Right.
Because you're not Japanese.
Well,
you know, people treat you differently.
Yeah.
Because you're not Japanese, and he was getting the A1 treatment. He was on his way to becoming a frequent flyer, being treated like a real Japanese person, which is very rare. If you read the book, Jake Adelstein's book, Tokyo Vice, you'll get a glimpse of that world. And I do recommend you all read Tokyo Vice. It's a great read,
mm-hmm.
and Jake's a very good guy. So you get that idea of what it's like to be a foreigner being treated as a Japanese person. It's sort of like something out of a Jules Verne book.
Yeah.
It's like science fiction almost.
Yeah, and that's the way a lot of teams treat their players. But one of the most interesting, I think, phrases that I heard in his talk was the resource efficiency phrase, which I love. I love the term.
Wow.
It
sounds like a buzzword more than a real useful expression to me.
Well, I don't know if it's a useful expression, but I loved it. I liked it. I like the approach. You can really get a sense of the idea because they have limited resources, so you've got to be very efficient with it. So I completely understand it, but I'm not loving the results I'm seeing per se. I mean, in recent, the past
the
2 years.
You mean the end product as we see in the standings every year?
I guess I'm looking at number of wins. I suppose I shouldn't.
Yeah.
I shouldn't.
No. That's because, you know, as much as I talk about the component parts of baseball teams and I go on and on about it, what matters at the end of the day are two things: where you are in the standings
mm-hmm.
and how much money you're making.
Yep. And,
and the Carp do very well in one of those respects. The Carp are the only team in Japan that every year reports they make a profit.
Yeah, I remember.
We may not be talking about a big profit. We might be talking about, yep, we made $1.50 last year. We cleared $1.50. But that's a massive difference from these teams that have billions of dollars of cash flow or millions of dollars of cash flow, but lose, you know, they're $5 or $6 million in the red every year.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, and I thought you guys were going to get into how they go about acquiring these players and how they do the evaluations on the players, and he doesn't have anything to do with that, obviously, that's why I call them the I dotter and the T crosser, but what he does is important, obviously, but I know baseball's a team game, and the thing I remember when I was listening to this is that organizations win championships, not mm-hmm. players.
Well,
but the players, okay.
Let me why don't you go ahead with that analogy and I won't interrupt this time.
He's crossing his fingers. I don't know if that's the good one or the bad cross, but anyway, I mean, it's not the players alone, but obviously the organizations put those players on the field. They put the coaches on the field. They're in charge, and that's why you can look at an organization and say that's what wins the championship. It's not just the players doing it by themselves. So I would like
to see. Yeah, the players didn't magically show up on the field.
Yeah, I'd like to see more on-field success with what they do, and I'm, you know, I've talked about that, especially I think the past 3 years, because even 3 years ago or three seasons ago, I thought they had good enough players to compete a little bit better, but they just came up short in some areas. And that was all on field. That was all mental stuff. That was things that the players had to get over. But I think it comes from the front office. It comes from the top down. If the head is strong, then the rest of the body. I mean, obviously, you need a good foundation, but the head has to be strong too. So,
well, the carp. Yeah, there are always questions not about how good the front office is, but how much trouble and chaos that the carp ownership presents to that team, which tends to be on the fairly high on the index level.
Yeah.
They tend to get in the way and cause trouble more than anything.
Well, you know, he talked about, you know, the innovative acquisitions, and I know that they have the Baseball Academy in the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't seem like they've always hit the nail on the head in terms of foreign player acquisitions. I mean, sometimes they come up with some really productive guys, and then other times you're like, you know, I remember a couple of players, and I'm not going to throw their names and throw them under the bus, but since I've taken this job in the past 10 years, there have been some players I really looked at and I thought, what about this guy made them think that he was going to have success here? Because I don't see it. And obviously they've gone through a lot of foreign players in these past 10 years. And I know it's difficult. I know it's hard, but
telling him, you know, while we were talking is I was completely blown away when I did a study about the cost effectiveness of foreign acquisitions by different Japanese teams. And it was like the Swallows and the Carp were like, they could have a, you know, if they had a competition, these teams would be, you know, if it was all about who made the best acquisitions consistently, you know, who paid as little as possible for the best possible talent, for the most efficient talent, the Carp and the Swallows would win hands down. And as we've seen the past 15, 20 years, you look at the guys who are successful in NPB, and what do you see a lot of in the last 10, 15 years? You see a lot of guys playing for other teams who started their careers in Japan with the Carp or the Swallows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they're the chief, and the Fighters to some degree have become one of those chief importers. You know, they're the ones out kicking the tires in the States and bringing in the good talent, and then those guys' contracts run out. Oryx has gotten a little bit there. SoftBank has gotten a little bit there. But those teams are still basically – the rest of NPB is often scavenging the talent from other teams. And the Carp and the Swallows between them are the two biggest providers of that talent. So it is quite efficient. The Carp – you know, talking about the Carp efficiency is really, really good. You know, you may not – in overall in terms of team value – I mean, and they have picked some duds. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But they're not paying anything for the duds. And instead, you look at the Carp on the field, you know, you look at the Carp foreign rosters now and you see, well, you know, you look at and you see Kia's there, and Kia looked like he was going to be really good here. I think he kind of soured on Japan a bit.
That's a good way of putting it.
And he's all bubbly. And then after a run of success, I think he soured with the way they dealt with ups and downs.
Because
it was like he stopped being bubbly. Okay. And Brad Eldred has been very good for them. He was a very good and obvious pickup. I mean, he might have cost them a lot of money to pry away from the Detroit Tigers, but he was very effective for them. And
right.
Nicolaio and Dennis Sarfate and Rainel Rosario.
Rosario, yeah. Yeah, he was really good for them.
Rosario. is really a guy. If he makes, you know, if he makes another adjustment to Japanese baseball, and he's not old, he's, I think, 24.
Yeah, he's really young, yeah.
He's very young. This guy could be the, you know, he has a chance. If he takes a big step forward, he could be the best foreign player in Japan.
Next year, I believe you, yeah.
So this is where the Carp are. And, you know, if you're a poor team, you know, in that respect, and this guy is there working within the budget, you know, who can we get? Who can we not get? And by and large, that part of the picture has always worked well. The Carp's problem has been in when these guys become successful, now what we do, because we can't afford to have really successful team players on our team.
Yeah.
And that's essentially the Carp problem, because although they're profitable because they make a lot of money. They have a very innovative licensing.
Mm-hmm.
Their products licensing is the best is the most creative in Japan.
Yeah.
And they do have a good nationwide fan base. and who consume this stuff. So they make money off of that and selling trinkets and, you know, and getting people into the ballpark, really basic old-fashioned stuff, but they don't have cash flow. So they can't spend millions and millions of dollars on players. They got to pay them chicken feed and things. Why Hirooki Kuroda finished the last 8 years of his career in the major leagues is because the Carp made a bad business, the Carp ownership made a decision that they wanted to cash in on Tomonori Maeda's success instead of pay Hirooki Kuroda, instead of paying the best pitcher in the Central League what he was worth.
Right, right. Well, you know, resource efficiency. It's a good phrase. I'd like to see him do more. You know what I really wanted you to ask him, though, is why Kenjiro Nomura walked away after this this past season, and why they turned to Koichi Ogata as the guy on the field. That would have been some, maybe he had some insight that he could have shared with you. I wish you would have asked him that.
I hadn't thought about that because that was a big one. I did ask somebody recently who, I was asking Carp beat writers about Kenjiro Nomura because he kind of speaks very straight, but he's very complicated and he's very smart, but you don't always, you know, he does things inexplicably to me. He does things I can't figure out, but every time I talk to him, I come away thinking what a smart guy he is. But, what I heard was that he being manager didn't really work for him and his family, and that his family was sort of asking him, you know, when can we not do this?
Right. Yeah.
And Hisanobu Watanabe was another guy who walked away at a fairly successful point in his managing career. And he told me 3 days ago that was the principal reason why he quit as Cebu Lions manager after the 2013 season, was his family had been is bugging him, saying, like, do we have to do this every year?
Mm.
And he said, okay, well, we've lost. We're getting there, so let's get out. So anyway.
All right. Well, thank you very much for doing the interview, man. I appreciate it. You surprised me. I forgot you were going. I had heard, and then I forgot, and then I remembered, but then I forgot to remember, and then I remembered to forget.
I'll tell you a very brief anecdote for me, which means it'll be under a half an hour.
And at least you know that.
I'm aware.
That's the first step of curing the problem.
I just adjusted the brain-mouth connection to limit it.
Admitting the problem is the first step.
Now, the winter meetings this year have been fairly slow because there have been basically one or two minor trades and maybe one second tier trade and minor. There haven't been free agent signings until everyone was waiting for one big thing to go the other day. And so things were a little slow and people were going, this is kind of boring. And then the Japanese reporters who work with me at Kyoto News were saying, this is kind of boring. And I'm running around my first winter meetings. I'm like the terrier in the lobby of the Grand Hyatt Hotel and somebody throwing a frisbee. I'm going, wow, there's the Carp guys. Wow, there's the Oryx guys. Wow, there's Hisanobu Watanabe, who I get along with well. Oh, there's, you know, there's all these guys. Oh, is that the Rakuten guys? I don't know. I recognize this guy. And And they're going like, Jim, calm down. This is boring. I'm going, no, this is heaven. I'm in heaven. I've got 30 major league teams, many of whom I have acquaintances with from people who come to Japan or people who used to come to Japan. I've got 7 Japanese teams, many of whom have all brought their foreign scout, their American and Western Hemisphere scouts with them to network with office and network with other scouts and major league teams and agents. And these people all have stories, and I am in heaven. It's wonderful. And the guys are going, this is boring. And I'm going, No, it's beautiful.
So there's Jim fun. Chasing all the frisbees in the lobby, and there the other guy's saying, look at this guy chasing all these frisbees.
Yeah, it's wild. It's fun. It's really interesting.
Well, I can tell you this. It's been pretty much Snoozeville back here in Japan, so let's talk about what's been going on here. This past week, Daisuke Matsuzaka was introduced on the same day that, and he was introduced by the Hawks, on the same day that Hiroyuki Nakajima joined the Oryx Buffaloes. And so,
yeah, former teammates.
Yeah, and these guys used to play with the Lions together. And I'm looking at the moves that Oryx made after the Nakajima signing. They signed Tony Blanco, formerly of the Chunichi Dragons and DeNA Bay Stars, and then Brian Bullington, who formerly from the Hiroshima Carp, so another example of a Carp player joining.
Coming out of the fish farm there.
Right. And you add that to Eiichi Koyano in the offseason work, and they've done some good things. I guess we can expect to hear soon that they're going to re-sign Chihiro Kaneko, their ace, and he'll be coming back as well, probably.
Yeah, so, the Oryx guys here, the assistant general manager and the head of overseas acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
I'll skip his name because I don't recall it offhand, was telling me basically they are set. They came here. They didn't expect to get anybody, and that they also have – they're very confident that Kaneko will come back.
Yeah. I like most of the moves. I just – I'm thinking Blanco, Bullington, Koyano. I'm thinking – 2 out of 3 ain't bad in that situation. We don't really know what to expect from Hiroyuki Nakajima. He has had, when I start to think about it, he's had his issues with some histories, at least since I've been back here. When he's healthy, he's very productive. And as soon as he went to the States, he had some lower body issues. And I remember in the Japan series, I think it was 2007 or 2008, he had a rib cage injury, but still managed to help out the team a little bit and contribute to that championship.
Right,
so.
Right. 2009, he was Japan's shortstop at the WBC and basically didn't play after Japan got to the United States. And Kataoka, his teammate from the Lions, had to become the shortstop and did quite a good job.
But yeah, you might recall that when I mentioned about the number of the guys who are stateside who probably would be better off returning home, that these two guys were on my list. And back. They are back
good
now.
You, John, so. I didn't expect to see Matsuzaka, but I think with the Matsuzaka thing was and our former colleague Silky. Silky Shintaro Kano, or Kano as I call him. I call him Robinson, actually. predicted that we were discussing this, and his question was very much on the money, literally on the money. He said, "How much is SoftBank paying him that Matsuzaka is announcing he's moving to Japan before the winter meetings, before his agents going around, who's going to, shop this guy who is a useful pitcher in the major leagues? So how much did SoftBank have to get to lure this guy back to Japan?" And the answer is $12 million, $13 million.
Over three-year deal.
Which is more than he was going to get guaranteed, which was a bit more than he was going to be looking at in the MLB. He was going to be looking at a minor league contract and a camp invite, and then probably $1.5 million a year.
All right. So that's a good chunk of change for him to come back. And I don't think it was money-based, but we'll see. I mean, I think he's going to be – obviously, he knows how to pitch to Japanese hitters. He's going to benefit from the fact that not everybody is trying to take him deep a lot of times, and that they're just trying to get the bat on the ball. So maybe it'll change his approach a little bit. And this is not going to be anything new for him. And he's pitching in a pitcher-friendly park as well, and they play pretty decent defense behind him. I think he's going to be fine.
Yeah, I was talking to the head of baseball operations for the Baltimore Orioles. He used to be their international scout. And when he was talking, our conversation was specifically about the adjustments that Japanese batters and pitchers face going to the majors. And when he started talking about that, my Daisuke Matsuzaka alarm was going off. He said, they pound the zone in Japan. They throw strikes. The best pitchers who go to the majors all throw strikes like nobody's business in Japan. And then as soon as they get to the majors, some of them start to get, you know, they get the pitching yips and they start working.
Keigawa, yeah.
Right. They start pitching out of the zone. And Terry Collins said exactly the same thing. He said, they go over the, he's, they said they, in Japan, they're working inside out the way they do in the States. They go for strikes and then they get ahead of you and they make you chase out of the zone. But when they go to America, all of a sudden they're trying to get you to swing at a pitch 5 inches out of the zone, and, you know, on the first pitch. Okay, if you don't swing, we'll go for one that's 3 inches out of the zone.
Yeah, and I did a post about a blog post about Matsuzaka, but you know what? His walk rate was virtually the same. He didn't change his walk rate at all.
No, but that's because he's in a different context, so it doesn't mean the same thing.
Right, but I saw with my own eyes he pitched differently, but his walk rate was about the same. That's
and he slowed down. He was a moderately slow in Japan to being
excruciatingly slow.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody knows Matsuzaka is sort of like, oh, he's. Hold on, where are you going? Matsuzaka is about to throw his next pitch. That's okay. I'll go get a coffee. I'll be ready by the time. You know, I'm only going to miss one pitch.
Maybe, even if there's a line. But Tony Blanco, I think, is a decent pickup. But of course, he and Bullington are both 34. Brian didn't have a great year last year, and obviously, injury took him out of ended his season prematurely. So I'm just not sure how they're going to work. It looks like, you know, on the surface, it looks like, oh, we remember last year the SoftBank Hawks made a bunch of deals in the offseason, brought in some free agents, brought in some quality players, and it led to a Japan Series victory. So here, maybe that's the business model, or they've set up the blueprint for winning a championship, and here comes the Oryx, and they're spending some money, and they're picking up a lot of free agents, but I don't think they're the same quality, and obviously, they don't need as much if they come back with the same team. Of course, I'd like to see them put Sato at the back of the bullpen and let him close games because I think he was their best reliever. And we'll see how that works out as they move toward camp and everything. I get the idea that Hirano is going to be the setup man and that they're going to put Sato at the back of the bullpen.
They could do either of those because they're both pretty good. I mean, Hirano had struggles. You know, as Japanese teams do, the bullpens tend to struggle at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Because these guys get, you know, it's like 40 mule train.
Yeah, well, he struggled. I mean, for me, he was not as sure a pitcher as Sato was. But, yeah, they're both pretty good. You're right. Maybe this could push him over the top. Obviously, we'll look and see before we make our predictions in March. But at the moment, they probably won the battle of player acquisition on the surface.
I don't know if they beat SoftBank, but they have to, you know,
this offseason.
Yeah. But, you know, it's very much right now, Oryx getting into it is a real change. People were talking about this at the winter meetings. They were saying, like, Oryx used to be penny pinching. Everybody knew they had the money.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, they're saying that it's almost as if they decided we could actually make money if we have a good team. Now, that remains to be seen. They still don't, you know, what they need is a plan to get people in the seats and, you know, and improve their brand if they're going to make money off of being successful. But they seem to actually have a plan, which is new. Mm. Oryx having a plan is probably not plan and Oryx. I probably never used those two words in the same sentence before.
Yeah.
And so, but they're playing catch up with the Hawks. I think that they're, With the exception of Koyano, who I don't really see as any value. Koyano is well past his best used by date.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really see that except as in taking him away from a team that could have used him, such as the Lions, where he would have been a useful fit. But anyway, yeah, Oryx is in that, but they're being aggressive and they're following a plan. So I'm really excited about the Pacific League pennant race next year. These two teams are like, Oryx got just enough taste of blood last year.
Some of it their own.
Man, they are right now. They tasted blood and they liked it.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're going for it. So this is going to be a lot of fun. I was very impressed with the Oryx, Chief Mr. Kato, who was here in San Diego, he and I spoke, and he spoke sabermetrics, so we were talking the same language.
Oh.
And I'm thinking, of course, you know, when you're a sabermetrics guy, when you see somebody speaking your language, you think, the first thing is, you're quite impressed because it's not that common. Mm-hmm. Just like you're on the street and you hear somebody speak Japanese, you think, wow, he's one of us in a sense.
Right,
he's one of us foreigners who can speak Japanese. And that's the light clicks. And so we had a common language and we spoke that. And I was getting into that. He wasn't one of the guys who were saying, you know, I like his makeup. I like the way, you know, and using as many baseball, scouty, old timer, cigar chewing, tobacco spitting jargon expressions like, I like his feel for inside pitches and how he raises his back foot. And I'm going, okay,
no right, fire. Next.
Exactly. That's a language that I can respect, but I'm not that fluent in it.
All right.
So, okay. So anyway, so that's Oryx. And that was really, really interesting that they were here. SoftBank was also here. And I thought SoftBank was done, and they told me they were done. And then bingo, here's the next news. SoftBank is after the 2015 version of Chris Sedden.
Who would be?
Rick Vanderherk. Rick
right.
Vanderherk is a Dutch international pitcher
mm-hmm.
who had a brief outing with the Washington Nationals, I believe. And he went to Korea in 2013, won a one-year contract with a one-year option for the Samsung Lions. And now we're looking at 2 years, $4 million for this guy. SoftBank has made him an offer. I heard that.
Where was he this year? He was still in Korea?
Samsung Lions, yeah. He led the...
So
he led
2013 and 14?
No, last year he apparently went over there and he corrected some mechanical flaws and his delivery apparently is much more compact now. He's a big guy. You know, he's the typical Dutch big guy. And anyway, so...
No, he pitched 2 years in Korea is what
Korea.
I was asking?
Okay. 2013, 2014. He's now a free agent. And the Hawks are reportedly in a bidding war over him. He's been reported as being already signed by SoftBank. And in fact, his Wikipedia page says he pitches for SoftBank, but Wikipedia sometimes gets ahead of itself. Mm. And the Hawks guy told me, no, the deal is not done. It was not done as of 2 days ago here in San Diego, but it's been reported that he's been signed and he's been made a serious offer, but the Giants may still be in that.
Mm.
Okay, so that's Japan. Now we have guys in the States.
And yeah, my first thing was obviously, and I saw a report today that Takashi Toritani, his agent was blathering or whatever you want to call it.
He was rolling, baby. It was Scott Forrest and he was putting on his lounge show.
Yeah, well, and apparently part of his lounge show was to say that multiple teams are, I don't know, the Japanese said more than one, so
the team was interested in
Toritani, and I'm like, you know, as soon as I tweeted it, one of the tweets came back and hit me with, well, what are the teams? And I'm like, yeah, don't we all want to know?
Well, I was surprised because knowing what things that having experience Scott stuff that comes out of Scott Boris's mouth
stuff
when he was yeah I know almost like not sewage that would be inappropriate
flushables
it's like the Salvation Army. You just never know what this guy's gonna come up with, you know, like, wow, you got that, cool. Anyway, when he was Matsuzaka's agent, he kept saying, well, we know what the market is for a 26-year-old free agent pitcher in the major leagues. And the only problem was, one, Matsuzaka wasn't a free agent, and two, at that point, before the Cubans, you know, the next Cuban revolution has occurred, there weren't 26-year-old free agent pitchers in the major leagues. They didn't exist. So he was saying he deals a lot in non sequiturs or in illogic, but he did take, you know, what you see in the media is the distillation of what he said and the interpretation of what – so much of what yesterday people were coming up to me, my guys were coming up to me and the people, my former colleagues at the Yomiuri sitting behind me were discussing. We were trying to percolate. We were trying to refine what Scott Boris said into meaningful information.
How many filters do you need to do that?
Man, you need a filter. You need like heavy-duty filter. This is heavy lifting, you know. A lot of it is just noise. But what he did say, and I will clarify, and he did clarify because Scott Boris goes on and on and on, and you never know when he's going to stop.
I wonder what that's like.
It's like a roulette wheel. It looks like it's going to stop. Oh, it's still going. Okay.
Like I said, I wouldn't know what that's like.
I think I've just been zinged. Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. Scott, Boris, and I are kindred spirits. Okay, thank you. Okay, I want some of that money. Okay. Anyway, I'm just trying to, you know, go on. There's so much to discuss here. Anyway, so basically to distill what Scott Boris clarified eventually was that Tory Tani is, according to Scott and Boris, on the list of candidates to fill a need for a number of teams. He is not a target. There is no team in the major leagues who are saying we need to get Tory Tani.
Right.
Zero.
I wouldn't think that was the case, yeah.
Okay, zero.
Yeah.
But he is among a number of candidates to fill a job where they're marketing him as a second baseman.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy who is a second baseman, but who can also play short and who can also play third and who has a track record nonetheless in Japan, but a track record of a guy who hasn't missed an inning since 2003.
Right.
So very durable in that. So he has a lot of positives going for him. He's a better player than Nakajima was when Nakajima was 2 years younger.
Mm-hmm. And he's
Nakajima's numbers look better because of their context, but he's a better player than Nakajima was.
Right, and he's
they have essentially the same power.
He's going to be playing at the age of 33 next year.
34. 30, he's already 34.
Yeah.
Oh, hold on. No. You're correct. 33 and 31. Correct.
33. So I talked to a front office guy, and he said that Tory Tani is a very talented and very tenacious winning player, but that's about as far as he would go. And then I talked to a scout who said that he doesn't know anybody who, you know, in the scouting world who thinks that he's defensively a big league shortstop. And what he said eventually was that if he really wanted to go to the States, he would have gone before now.
And
he'll always have better options than Japan. That's what the scout said.
In Japan. Okay. Yeah. I agree with that. He wants to go now. I think he's kicking himself. I think he was not in the ideal situation. I don't know what his logic was for signing a 3-year contract before his walk year before to stay with Hanshin, except that he appreciated that he loves the fact that Hanshin thinks the world of him. You know, it's human nature. But he chose that instead of going to the majors. But I think now he's saying I've been on this boat and I want to try a different one. And I respect that. And I also think the world of him as a player. And I think nobody thinks he's a major league shortstop, but he's a major league shortstop. He's a major league, you know, they're gambling. Could he be a major league second baseman? I'm guessing that he can be because of his track record, and he could be the, you know, he'll be a similar major league second baseman to Akinori Iwamura, who was very useful until injuries. You know, he was useful as he was, but he's a smarter player than Iwamura. As much as I love Aki, he's a smarter player than he's one of the smartest players in Japan. And right. I think he can make that transition. I'm banking that he can make it, but here's the issue. Nobody's going to make a commitment to him. Nobody has him as their target. Now, Boris said, and I asked him, no, what is the market? He said this year, and the media reports would back this up. This year is a very good market if you're a middle infielder. Right now, teams, every trade that is mentioned, virtually every trade that is mentioned is the team getting a shortstop or a second baseman in exchange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard all this stuff. And
yeah, so there's going to be, when this merry-go-round, when these trades settle down in the next week and a half, and a couple of free agents go, Lowry and Stephen Drew, there's going to be teams that are saying, you know, we didn't get the guy we want, and the guy we think we can acquire or the guy in our organization is not ready to hit at the major league level. So why don't we give Tory Tani a 2-year contract or a 1-year deal and see what he can do?
Yeah.
And I think some team is going to do that. Now, Boris says, now here's the problem. Tory Tani's timeline is very difficult because he's basically taking the policy. Boris said, oh, no, he has other options in Japan besides Hanshin. But then he repeated and said, well, Hanshin needs to have a deadline. So he ain't going back and going to the Giants. He ain't going back and going to the SoftBank or Nippon Ham, which would be a great fit for him. But
and for them, yeah, that's a great team.
Yeah. But he's not going to do that. But basically, I had a theory that he might stick around and do a free agent, a camp invite, because he can always go back to the Tigers. But that he doesn't want to disrespect the Tigers and say, and take them lightly. The attitude is, and he has a ton of respect for the Tigers. They want to wrap this up. They want to make a decision not much later than the new year. Now, Boris said he expected a deal before the new year. I think it might take a little longer than that.
I think so too.
He knows more about it than I do. I'll have to give Scott Boras credit for that.
You look at Toritani, you look at Norichika Aoki, you look
very
at
similar players.
Ichiro Suzuki. These guys, they're going to be these garden variety fringe players right now. And I don't understand why Aoki is at that point, because he was a contributor to Milwaukee and they shipped him out like they didn't need him, and you would think that Kansas City wanted to keep him since he helped them get to the playoffs, but the way they kept yanking him in mid to late game situations because he wasn't a big rabbit like their other defensive players in the outfield.
Yes. Well, because when you're Kansas City, you play a different game. Kansas City is a team that is very similar to Trey Hillman's Fighters in 2006 and 2007.
And I understand that, and I see that, but it's weird how he was productive and he's still treated like this garden variety fringe player. But the Ichiro's on the market, and the fact that Toritani is going to be looking for work like he is, it's just weird to me. And Kawasaki's still out there, right?
I saw this. I didn't see Kawasaki's agent here, and I don't know Kawasaki's agent, but basically he's set on going to Toronto in the same role he's had for the last 2 years, which is minor league contract.
Elevator.
And definitely he's going to play.
He's elevator boy. Yeah, he goes up and down, and when somebody gets hurt, he's
fine with that. Yeah. And they love him, and he loves being there. So that's a good, he's getting enough money. He'll probably get a signing bonus with his minor league contract too.
Well,
that'll probably tie to, like a $400,000 or, a few hundred thousand dollars that'll tie him over.
Yeah, well, I'd just like to see Toritani get settled. If he's going to go over there, get a team as quickly as possible. But if Boris is going to be his agent and talk about multiple teams being interested and all
Boris
this stuff.
Boris talking about an early deadline is like the dentist saying this ain't going to hurt. You're just not used to, or actually it's not hurting when the dentist says it's not going to hurt.
This won't hurt a bit.
Yeah, it always seems like a bit of a stretch. I expected Boris as his agent. This could take until April.
Yeah.
But so it is interesting, but I'll give you my take on Aoki. And Aoki, I can't speak for Milwaukee because I didn't really have a good gauge on what he was doing. But the fact that he was playing with a pennant contender, a divisional championship contender this year, changed my focus on a variety of things. And I got a lot of looks at Aoki this year. And his game, if you look just at things at the standard numbers, at the actual raw numbers, his game is going down every year, but the context changes every year. The offensive levels in the major leagues are going down every year, and he was playing in a park last year in which the offensive levels are the lowest in the majors.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you look at his offense last year as a total, not just he did really well in the second half and he did really badly in the first half.
Or
that total was a very productive season.
Yeah.
And the current market in the major leagues, now the current market in the major leagues for a right fielder who can play some defense was set last week by the Atlanta Braves when they gave Nick Markakis. They gave Nick Markakis somebody – there's some drug use in Atlanta, I suspect. Or Nick Markakis has a friend who has pictures of somebody.
$44 million
for Nick Markakis.
Yeah, I don't know about the 4 years, and that's probably they overpaid on that contract. But he was a productive player for a while with the Baltimore Orioles.
His numbers were made in Baltimore in the American League East.
Yeah.
Okay, Nick Markakis's numbers are not any better than Aoki's.
And that brings us
in the context of where he played. Yeah. Nick Markakis' season last year was the same as Aoki's, and Nick Markakis' season was his best in 3 years.
Yeah,
Aoki's was his was not his best in 3 years. He's basically been a carbon copy every year.
And so that
Aoki's a better player than Mark Kakis, but he's also 2 years older. So somebody's not going to overpay. Let's say all those numbers are wrong, and Aoki is maybe slightly less valuable than Mark Kakis and worth only a 2 year deal. I think Aoki's looking at, if Mark Kakis was overpaid, and I think a lot of people would think so, the way the market is, 2 years, maybe, I'm going to say $18, $20 million for Aoki. If you asked me that a month ago, I would have said 2 years, $12 million. But I think he's going to be in the $18 million. And right now the Royals are saying, Christ, he was a bargain.
Yeah.
And now his agent is throwing big numbers at the Royals. And so he may not stay with the Royals.
Yeah.
Because of that, like, but Ned Yost said, yes, we'd love to have him, but the numbers are a little scaring us.
Yeah, I saw that. Now, Ichiro, you know, I wrote in the blog post that I wrote the other day, nobody's really looking for a 41-year-old outfielder at the end of his career to sit around on the bench and maybe pinch hit or come in and fill in. And I just know where he goes. I don't see a spot for him. There's a lot of major league teams out there, but I don't see it.
Okay. Well, you hit this on the head. He's exactly right now in the same market position as Toritani, except that he's in a better position than Toritani because he's not a question mark.
Mm-hmm.
You know what he is, you know what the upside is, and if there is a downside, then he doesn't have anything but defensive value.
And that's deteriorating, yeah. But
yeah, it's deteriorating, but he's still better. He's still better than average defensive outfielder. And at the age of 41, he's still better than average. And he's still a very good base runner. And so he has value. So what teams are going to look at is when the other guys are gone, who's left? Ichiro Suzuki is going to be there. He's going to find a place. There are jobs for Ichiro Suzuki. It's going to be a job in the area. His value is probably not as high as Norichika Aoki's right now. I would say it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So Ichiro might be looking at a 1 year, but because he has a track record of success and he is an exciting player who will bring people into the stands, I think 1 year, maybe seven million or 6 million or 5 million or 4 million, but whatever, he's going to be in the major leagues next year. He needs 136 hits to get to 3,000 in the major leagues. He's going to be in the majors next year. He's going to get his halfway there and maybe halfway the year after. He's not going to get hurt. He's going to find a job somewhere. He's going to get into 115 games and maybe 200-300 at bats.
All right. We got to wrap it up here. But, you know, while you were talking, I just thought of two teams maybe that probably could use him. One, San Diego.
Yeah.
But that's good for him because he doesn't have to worry about trying to drive the ball anyway. And then another place, San Francisco.
San Francisco, no. As a left field.
Left field, yeah. Exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, left field. Okay, see, it took me a while to realize that because my first thinking of Ichiro is the player you want right field but Hunter Pence now is a better outfielder than Ichiro Suzuki is. So at least in right field in that park.
Yeah.
So I was thinking not right field. I've always thought Ichiro as a right fielder would have been a great fit for the Giants in that respect. I'm not a big fan of Ichiro's overall game because I've gone on about that and I won't today. But just the things that he does do, get hits, and he's very steady he's very durable. He's very steady. He's got speed. The things that he does do, he's going to do well. You have to downplay the fact that he has no on-base percentage and deal with that. But he could play left field, although I think the Giants would like to have him. He's not a team that's going to get playing time with the Giants.
Right. Yeah.
He'd be the guy who comes out, if the starting pitcher's good that day and they need somebody in the seventh inning.
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't think he wants to be that guy. I think the Giants would probably not be a good fit for him. They'd like to have him in that role, and he doesn't want to be in that role. So,
all righty. we'll see where these guys go. It'll be interesting to watch and something else for us to keep an eye on in the off season. And we'll look at the other moves. And we're going to have one more show before the year is out. So hopefully it'll be in 2 weeks. I think it'll be in 2 weeks. So we'll plan it that way. We'll have a meeting.
It'll be out in 2 weeks for sure.
Yeah, we'll have a meeting right here on the air. So, yes, and we did get some comments on the Facebook page saying that the last discussion about the Hall of Fame wasn't long enough, which
Claudio,
I agree.
Good point, Claudio, absolutely.
I agree, and we apologize. But sometimes the producer looks up and says it's time, and we just got to go, like right now.
Yeah.
So we will talk.
No, I don't want to go.
You be quiet there. So please send your questions and comments to yakyujohn@gmail.com or leave us a note on the Facebook page, and we'll talk to you next time. Enjoy your off season.
Bye from San Diego.
One World Sports is the exclusive home of the Yomiuri Giants in North America and features live coverage of all Giants home games. Please contact your local cable provider to find out how you can watch One World Sports.